permanent fund has a savings account and a checking account. And all we're doing is moving money from the checking account to the savings account.
Republican lawmakers look for another way to fund the state budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the history of complaints against the nursing home the state recently took over.
We write up what their issues are, and they put in a corrective action plan, and they work it for a while, and then they kind of stop.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
For weeks, the legislature has been at a stalemate over its budget deficit. The Republican majority has been trying to secure a three-quarter vote to tap the state's rainy day account, but they need Democratic support to do that, which means increasing education funding and expanding Medicaid. Now that the legislature is in its second special session, some Republican leaders are trying to find an accounting workaround that would let them plug the deficit without reaching a deal with the Democrats. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez joins us from the Anchorage Legislative Information Office, where lawmakers are meeting. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
So the annual costs of running the state are about $5 billion, but the legislature has only $2 billion in revenue that it can apply to that amount. What's the plan now to find the rest of the money?
Well, it's not like the state is broke, even though we've got a budget shortfall. Beyond the state's unrestricted general fund, which is the pot of revenue that the legislature can use with no strings attached, and which mostly comes from oil taxes, there are a few other accounts that count as state money. The traditional rainy day account is the constitutional budget reserve, which has $10 billion in it. But there are some pretty weird rules for accessing it. It requires a three-quarter vote unless there are no other accounts that you can readily tap. If the budget reserve is your only real option, then you can access it with just a majority vote. The rub is that the state does have another big pot of money it can access with a simple majority vote, and that's the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve. To get easy access to the rainy day account, you need that money to basically go away.
So is the legislature looking at using the permanent fund to fill the budget deficit?
The short answer is no. They're just looking at playing an accounting trick. The way the permanent fund is set up, there's the corpus, which requires a vote of the people to access, and then there's the earnings reserve account, which comes from investment earnings off of the corpus. That earnings reserve is where the dividends come from. What the Republican leadership is considering doing is moving money from that dividends reserve account into the corpus. The legislative finance director, David Teal, describes it like this.
The permanent fund has a savings account and a checking account. And all we're doing is moving money from the checking account to the savings account.
So what would happen is the legislature would leave enough money to pay dividends, but they would move most of the money into the main fund itself, which basically takes that money off the table and then lets them get an easier vote on the rainy day account.
Does the Republican leadership have the support in their caucus to do this?
It's not unanimous by any stretch. On Wednesday, a group of six members of the House Majority Caucus, basically a mix of some of the moderate members and some of the Bush Democrats who caucus with them, sent a letter to the House Speaker saying they didn't like the plan. They're worried that if you went through with it and then you had a stock market crash, your dividends would be at risk. Representative Jim Culver, a Palmer Republican who signed the letter, told the Fairbanks Daily News Miner that his group should be known as the Musk Ox Coalition, because the approach they were taking with the permanent fund was like a bunch of Musk Ox circling around a baby to protect it. Without these six members of the majority on board, you basically don't have the votes to implement this plan of just moving pots of money. that empowers Democrats more when it comes to negotiations and makes a three-quarter vote look more necessary.
Alexandra, does it sound like they could figure out a solution to all of this soon?
Well, they haven't yet, but if they don't figure out something by June 1st, layoff notices get sent out to state employees, and if they don't pass a fully funded budget by July 1st, we get a partial government shutdown. These are some pretty strong deadlines that could spur lawmakers into action.
All right. Thank you, Alexandra. That was APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reporting from Anchorage. The Missile Defense Agency today confirmed it has selected Clear Air Station as its preferred location for a new type of radar system called long-range discrimination radar. The final decision will depend on the outcome of safety and environmental studies. The selection of Clear helps solidify Alaska's role as host to the ground-based mid-course missile defense designed primarily to shoot down warheads from North Korea. Clear is on the Parks Highway, 80 miles from Fairbanks. It already is home to an upgraded early warning radar system that will be part of the missile defense system. Ricky Ellison, chairman of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance, which accepts funds from the defense industry, says LRDR improves the view of the target, giving interceptors a better chance.
You want to see it just like a baseball player playing outfield. You want to be able to watch that ball once it's gets hit from the bat all the way into the mitt to make the best chance of catching the ball. Right now, we can't see it all the way through. We have to close our eyes for a good part of it, and then we have to look up and find it.
That's the long range part of the name. Ellison says the discrimination part is also vital to defeating an enemy missile.
When it goes through space, there's a lot of junk, there's a lot of parts, there's a lot of stuff in that, including countermeasures and including decoys and maybe a couple of warheads in there. So this radar is able to pinpoint exactly what the actual vehicle is, or the target vehicle is that's carrying the weapon.
The radar is expected to cost about $1 billion. Much of that will be spent on hardware and technology, though the system would require construction on site. The Missile Defense Agency says it hopes to have the new radar system operational by 2020. It's been a week since the state of Alaska took the rare step of assuming control of Prestige Nursing Home in Anchorage. State inspectors found dozens of violations during a visit to the facility, and the state says the nursing home had plenty of prior warning that it needed to improve. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Over the past 2 years, state inspectors have spent a lot of time inside Prestige Care and Rehabilitation Center of Anchorage. The facility has logged 4 times the number of complaints as Providence Extended Care, a similar-sized nursing home in the city. So for the nursing home's annual recertification review earlier this month, state and federal inspectors decided to show up on a Sunday morning, unannounced. Margaret Brody is the state's director of healthcare services.
We typically don't go in on a Sunday, but we did in this instance because anything that was wrong would show on a Sunday.
The inspectors talked to administrative staff, they poured through patient records, and interviewed every single one of Prestige's 98 residents. The investigation took about a week, and the results were alarming. Brody says inspectors found 50 violations, 8 in the most severe category, immediate jeopardy.
We were surprised at the number. It was extremely high.
At the end of the inspection, the department decided to take the unusual step of assuming temporary management of the facility. The inspection report is not yet public. In the past, Prestige has been cited for things like inadequate nursing care, failing to provide medication to patients, and for numerous problems with call lights and call light response times. Given the volume of complaints the health department has investigated over the past 2 years, Brody says the company had plenty of warning to correct problems before they escalated to the point of state management.
What's happened with Prestige is that we write up what their issues are, and they put in a corrective action plan, and they work it for a while, and then they kind of stop, and then they go right back to where they were.
So you've seen kind of a pattern of a facility that has complaints, improves, and then slips back again.
Yes. And I think the reason for that is that they bring in outside help to help them correct all the deficiencies, and then the outside help leaves.
Prestige Care is a for-profit corporation based in Washington State. They own 36 nursing homes across the western U.S. and 42 other senior facilities, like assisted living and independent living homes. Buffy Howard oversees 10 nursing homes for Prestige in the West. She wouldn't address whether the company was concerned about the number of complaints the facility has received over the last 2 years.
There's not a way to say that there were more complaints than normal, but it's something that we continue to look at on quality improvement. Each state is different in the amount of citations that are average. Each building is different on what is a normal amount of tags, so I can't really comment on the specifics on that.
Prestige has already corrected 5 of the 8 violations the most recent inspection uncovered in the immediate jeopardy category. The company has until June 4th to correct the other 3, which Howard describes as overarching administrative problems. She's confident Prestige will meet the deadline.
We do take these findings very seriously, and that the safety and welfare of our residents is priority. It's always our number one. This is a big deal, and we understand, and we've heard the state, and we're working together, very closely together in conjunction to fix and improve.
Margaret Brody with the state says one thing inspectors found is that Prestige didn't have enough staff to adequately care for patients. In response, she says the company has added another nurse at night. Overall, she's pleased with the progress Prestige is making. So is Noel Ray, the interim administrator hired by the state to oversee the facility.
Prestige has marshaled a lot of resources in here in terms of training and education, and that's been impressive. And I've seen a very clear and visible response to the survey and the decision to put in interim management.
Prestige will be subject to state and federal fines and is paying Ray's salary. Brody and her staff want to make sure the changes Prestige puts in place to get its license back won't evaporate when corporate leaders return to Washington State. They're focusing on making sure local staff are adequately trained to maintain high-quality care. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a 12-year-old self-styled ambassador from Sitka.
I just like want to go up to them and be like, hey, you want to be my friend? Everyone says I'm weird, but weird is awesome. I think weird is awesome.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The northern stretch of the Dalton Highway is expected to remain closed into next week. Meltwater from extensive overflow along the Sag River began flowing across the road last weekend, resulting in an initial closure Sunday, affecting miles 375 to 410 south of Dead Horse and the Prudhoe Bay oil field. The closed area was expanded about 40 miles on the south end and a few miles to Dead Horse on the north side Tuesday, as water began impacting additional sections of the highway. Department of Transportation spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says water no longer seems to be rising, but it will likely be several more days until the road reopens.
We're still waiting for the water levels to go down, and after the water levels go down, we still have to go in then and make some pretty significant repairs to quite a long stretch of road.
Bailey says the DOT briefly had to shut down some electronic navigational aids at the Dead Horse Airport as water came up. She says the DOT dug trenches to channel water away from the airport and some man camps, but some other lodging facilities remain flooded. Governor Bill Walker has issued a second disaster declaration in light of the ongoing flooding. The declaration enables DOT to request federal funds to help mitigate the damage. The University of Alaska Museum of the North opens a new exhibit tomorrow. Expedition Alaska Dinosaurs gives visitors the opportunity to experience paleontologists' quest and what they're finding in an underexplored region. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Amidst the stapling, drilling, and cutting of the dinosaur exhibit going up, Museum of the North Earth Science curator Pat Druckenmiller reflects on the aberrant natural environment Arctic Alaska dinosaurs roamed 70 million years ago.
There was actually forests where the North Slope is today. So it's a pretty crazy world. It was just totally different.
Druckenmiller has spent the last 8 years working in Alaska, looking for and finding evidence of dinosaurs in a part of the world where the creatures once walked, but few paleontologists have explored.
And so today we can float down places like the Yukon River, and we look at blocks of rock that have weathered out of the cliffs above, and we look at them and we go, wow, that's the size and the shape of a dinosaur footprint, and it's got three toes and sometimes skin impressions and so forth. So we know they're dinosaur footprints, and we find thousands of them.
The museum exhibit includes casts of footprints as well as fossilized bone fragments Druckenmiller and fellow scientists are using to identify and even discover new dinosaur species.
This is going to bring out some of the coolest finds that we've made. It includes actually probably at least remains of at least a couple of new species of dinosaurs that we're working on right now to publish.
Druckenmiller is working with Alaska Native speakers to come up with names for the new dinosaurs. The exhibit also takes visitors into what it's like to be a paleontologist exploring for dinosaur evidence in Alaska's backcountry.
It's epic, but it's also what Alaskans do. We go out and camp on gravel bars, and we go up and down the rivers, and they just do the same thing and bring back dinosaur bones.
Roger Topp heads up production at the museum and has accompanied the paleontology team to shoot photos and video. He's also involved in fleshing out an exhibit which includes dinosaur models, even one that moves. Snaps is hidden in a museum closet.
This is a life-size tyrannosaur of the sort you would find in Alaska 65 million years ago. And life-size tyrannosaur means it's about human size, so if a human gets inside this, it's not to scale. It is life size. So this guy, I expect, will probably make an appearance during the reception and should be making lots of appearances throughout the summer and into the school year.
Other kid-friendly parts of the exhibit are a big orange tent fashioned after one paleontologist used in the field and tubs of silt visitors can paw through to try and find fossils. Seeing it all come together and connecting scientific field work with the public is gratifying for Druckenmiller.
It's a great pleasure to me and a great relief to see it all finally come together. And I also recognize, though, it's also just a snapshot, because 10 years from now, I hope to be telling a much even broader story.
Druckenmiller says some of the special exhibit materials will be incorporated into the museum's permanent dinosaur display, which hasn't been updated in 30 years. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ann Hillman. This week on AK, a 12-year-old ambassador. Imagine you arrive in a world where it rains all year round and daylight swings from 17 hours in the summertime to a paltry 6 in the winter. And you're only 7 years old. That's the situation Jasmine Molina found herself in when she first got to Sitka, over 5,000 miles from her native city of Manila in the Philippines. Sitka's Filipino population has grown substantially in the past 5 years, but there isn't a good system to help new students transition to school. That is, until Jasmine came to town. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Hello, ang pangalan ko ay Jasmine Molina.
There's something about Jasmine that makes you want to talk to her.
It's a pretty big school. It's compared.
Maybe
to
it's her big brown eyes or her silky black hair, which she quickly tucks behind her ear while dialing her locker trumpet combination.
Locker's messy.
But it's probably her smile, which turns her face into a huge pair of parentheses.
I just want to go up to them and be like, hey, you want to be my friend? And they'll be like, yeah. And I'll be like, cool. Everyone says I'm weird, but weird is awesome. I think weird is awesome.
Oh, and she's got killer self-confidence. Again, not your typical middle schooler. Janelle Farver was Jasmine's language arts teacher last year.
She's funny, sensitive, and she's generous.
Janelle remembers the very first time she saw Jasmine at the grocery store with a bunch of other Filipino kids talking.
I thought, what is this little girl doing? She's talking so fast. And I just kind of observed a little bit. And then I saw her pointing out things and showing things. And I said, oh my gosh, I think this little girl's explaining how this store works.
Janelle saw her again a few years later. She'd grown a bit taller, but was doing the same thing.
I thought, I wonder if she's an ambassador. These kids all look very new and they're just wide-eyed and mouth agape, wondering what this is about, what this can is of. And there was Jasmine explaining it all.
And last year, when Janelle met her sixth grade class, Jasmine was in it, all grown up. Jasmine's dad is a fisherman and came to Sitka 5 years ago. Jasmine and her mom followed a month later.
I was really shy. I didn't really know anything about Sitka until my cousin showed me around the next day. There was a lot of tall people.
And not only that, but it was several degrees colder than in Manila, where Jasmine grew up.
I only had one jacket, and it was really cold, and there was a lot of snow on the ground.
As she got used to the cold, one thing that made a big difference to Jasmine was meeting other kids her age.
The first day I went to second grade, they're like, hey, what's your name? I'm like, my name's Jasmine, and I came from the Philippines. They're like, cool. I wanted to do the same thing and make people comfortable where they're at.
And it's something Jasmine has been doing ever since, greeting new families and showing their kids the ropes, from how to open a locker to getting around the building. It's more than middle school survival tactics. Jasmine is helping her classmates succeed in a Western school.
And for her to do it on her own volition and just to see a need and to step up to fill that need, I think that says a lot about her character.
At Blatchley Middle School, there are 29 Filipino students, and in the whole district, 121, making up 9% of the Sitka student body. At the moment, the Sitka School District doesn't have a designated Tagalog speaker or support group to help students orient themselves. But for now, Jasmine fills that gap.
I've had her, even I've brought her down to help me scold. They need to not be so chatty or whatever. I have her come and talk to them in Tagalog, too. Hear a lecture in the mother tongue. There's nothing like it.
Now, it's hard to imagine Jasmine yelling at anyone. And if you asked her if she's an ambassador or even a leader, she'd probably say no. She's just being a friend. Antoinette Partido remembers meeting Jasmine in dance class.
When I first got here, she talked to me instead of just ignoring me. I felt really happy about it.
The two girls connected pretty quickly, speaking in both English and Tagalog. They're now very good friends. Antoinette lives with her grandmother, who adopted her. She hasn't seen her parents for 5 years and describes her family as broken apart.
I don't really get to call them because I have school, my grandma has work, so we don't really have time to call them. I don't think that anyone would know, that my parents aren't here because I don't really show my feelings to them.
But Jasmine knows. And when we finish the interview, Jasmine takes Antoinette aside and says, "You're my one." She says it again with a big smile. "Don't forget, you're my one." And with that, Jasmine turns on her heels and heads out the door to go to her next class. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Jean Aspen, a writer of wilderness books and a nurse who lives in Homer.
I can't imagine living anyplace else. I was conceived in Alaska, and it has always brought me back. I think of myself almost like the salmon. I can't imagine really wanting to live anywhere else. I've spent about a third of my life in remote wilds with no one for company except the people who I went into the wilderness with. That's a long time, and it's very much my home. I've never not felt like an Alaskan. I have lived other places. I actually grew up during my in childhood in Tucson, Arizona. And in those days, it was quite a wild place. There were only 30,000 people in Tucson when I grew up there, and I spent a lot of time. I love the desert. I love any natural country, and Alaska is one of the few places where you can actually see natural country and be out for long periods of time without being cluttered with the human imagination, but can just see what the land has to say about itself. It's a very deep journey. It's not one you can superficially approach with your TV and your 5 minutes. If you want to get to know the land, you have to go with humility and expect to spend a long time listening, and then it begins to open. My early journey in life was a broadening journey where I needed to climb this mountain and that mountain, and it always seemed like the essence would be right beyond that horizon. Now that I'm in my mid-60s, I can no longer go so far. But what I have found is I actually can see down into life. I can see more on the small walk from our cabin to the creek to get water than I used to be able to see covering mountain ranges. So it's not about proving myself. It's about listening to the land.
Jean Aspen is a writer who lives in Homer. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Kwong, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Annie Feit and Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Join Alaska Public Media for a talk by boreal herbalist Beverly Gray on May 29th at 7 p.m. at Alaska Pacific University. Gray is the author of the national best-selling and award-winning book, The Boreal Herbal, Wild Food and Medicine Plants of the North. Gray explains the benefits of wild herbs and how they can best be incorporated into our everyday lives. Tickets and more information at alaskapublic.org, sponsored by Alaska Pacific University, a benefit for Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.